Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Howard County Executive Calvin Ball returns to our program. We'll talk about how the county has coped with the coronavirus and what help Howard County can expect from the American Rescue Plan, as well as other issues. Plus, a conversation with the wonderful singer Navasha Daya about her latest project. It's a new tribute album to Gil Scott-Heron. So that's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. Now we turn to an economist who is a leader in the socially responsible investment movement. Hazel Henderson says we need to rethink the money meme to create a more equitable and compassionate global economy. Hazel Henderson is speaking on Sunday afternoon in the online Logan Visionary Conference, sponsored by the American Visionary Art Museum here in Baltimore. She joins us today from St. Augustine, Florida, on Zoom. Ms. Henderson, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So you wrote a really fascinating piece a few months ago in a thing called the Washington Journal called Fixing the Money Meme, in which you argue that the money meme rules our lives and all lives in societies across the planet. What do you mean by the money meme? What is that?
Well, you know, human beings have used money almost since we came down out of the trees. So money was a wonderful invention, and humans have always used markets, you know, but they were local. And as our society scaled up more and more, the economics profession kind of began to focus on everything to do with the price system and forget about all of those unpriced valuable goods and services, whether it's carers in the home or taking care of elderly parents or raising children, or whether it's the services of the environment, which we are despoiling because it doesn't have any monetary value in our gross national product. And so I've been critiquing the GDP view of the world for many, many years, as have many other people. And unfortunately, the economics profession hasn't overhauled these models for many, many years. I mean, for example, I remember speaking at a conference in the European Union back in 2007 called Beyond GDP. And they were talking about all of these unpaid services in the social mutual aid community voluntary side of society, which has always been there and is really governed more by the principles of the golden rule, you know, caring and sharing with each other, and has always kind of enfolded the money system. And because of these economists and the textbooks focusing only on the money side, we have gotten into this situation where, for example, I was listening to Chris Shorter that you had on earlier, the city administrator that you have in Baltimore. And basically, this is a kind of rebalancing where you're looking at all of the other things going on in Baltimore, which may not be recorded in the city's GDP.
And you talk about the metrics being wrong with GDP. So if we were to refashion how we calculate GDP or replace GDP with something else, that does include the unpaid part of each society, what would that mean? How would that change our outlook and our understanding of global economy?
Well, let's look at the USA and the city of Baltimore, as well as we can look at the European Union or wherever else. And it just means that we wouldn't keep shortchanging investments that we need to make in infrastructure, which is the underpins all of the market and money-based systems. You know, if you don't have public goods and services, which are invested by governments, you know, in ports and roads and hospitals and public schools and internet and broadband, and all of those services would be shortchanged. And so basically the first stab at coming up with something more inclusive and therefore more equitable was the United Nations in 1995. No, I think it was the year 2000. They brought out an indicator they called the Human Development Indicator, which added in and estimated these services were provided by people who were unpaid in communities, largely women. And they totaled it up and estimated that 11 trillion of these unpaid services were provided by the world's women and 5 trillion by the world's men, you know, in helping building houses and growing food and all of that. And all of that was simply missing from the annual global GDP that year. So they were the first people that really looked at this. And then I created with the Calvert Group of Mutual Funds, the Calvert Henderson Quality of Life Indicators, which we brought out in the year 2000, the first time a private asset management firm had taken a stab at this, because we were looking at all of these social factors and the protection of workers, the protection of the environment, making sure that carers, childcare, and of course, during the pandemic, this has now become more obvious that you can't ignore these social services or the services of nature. So basically, gradually, the economic textbooks are beginning to change, but it's taken me 40 years of my life bringing all of this out. And it's been a hard slog, I have to tell you, Tom.
I bet it has. You've also wrote a piece a while back called Money is Not Wealth, and it was about cryptocurrencies. And you say that currencies are simply no longer a dependable store of value. Is it just cryptocurrencies that are having that effect on, you know, currencies like the U.S. dollar or the yen or the euro? And if so, where are we headed in that regard?
Well, I think cryptocurrencies and particularly, you know, the Bitcoin phenomenon, I refer to it actually as Bitcoin, because basically it has absolutely no value. And there are all of these false visuals of sort of shiny coins with a B on there. They don't exist. Bitcoin is simply a string of data in a computer. And so basically, not only these cryptocurrencies have really no intrinsic value, they're really speculative for people who are either afraid of their own government's ability to print money. See, because most government money is also kind of the full faith of the government. They call it fiat currencies. In other words, it's the government says, we promise to pay you. And so we've had a sort of crisis of confidence going on in all kinds of currencies. And the big new kid on the block, of course, is Facebook. And a lot of these big, gigantic social media companies, but particularly Facebook, jumped in with its currency, which it called the Libra. And this was going to grab the whole game away from both the other cryptocurrencies and the government money, whether it's dollars or yen or pounds. And so immediately the world central banks reacted in horror. and started developing their own competing digital currencies. So the essence of money is now become a public issue. And all over the world, NGOs are beginning to understand that the politics of money creation and credit allocation in all societies is kind of at the root of whether a society develops in a balanced way, both the social sector, the unpaid sector, as well as the money sector, if that happens equitably or if it steers off in unequal directions, like it has in the USA. So there's a big rethink going on. And basically, we realize that all money, all currencies really come down to the fact that they're social protocols. They're something that we believe in. And they sit on these various internet platforms. And the value comes from the extent to which people trust them and use them. That's all.
Yeah, everybody has to buy into it in order for it to work. And it is quite a thing to think that, you know, Facebook might be dictating the terms of that conversation. We're going to take a quick break. Hazel Henderson is an evolutionary economist and the founder of Ethical Markets. We'll have more with Hazel Henderson on the other side of this quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780. You can email us midday at WIPR.org. You can tweet us at midday WIPR. You can tweet me at Tom Hall WIPR. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the economist and author Hazel Henderson. She is an evolutionary economist and the founder of Ethical Markets. She's a leading proponent of socially responsible investing. She's written extensively about changing our basic understanding of money, including proposing strategies to achieve a more equitable and compassionate global economy. To join our conversation with Hazel Henderson, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, our Twitter handle at midday WIPR. So, Ms. Henderson, you write about love economies, these smaller mini economies that exist within the larger global economy. And also, when it comes to equity, as we were just mentioning before the break, talk about how the flawed way we are calculating GDP reinforces gender equity or racial inequity. Gender inequity and racial inequity. What does the way we're calculating this do to our understanding of what's fair and making sure that people are treated fairly in this global economy?
Well, Tom, when you look at the fact that GDP is a purely money-based flow of transactions, that's the only thing it counts, and all the macro statistics that we use, whether it's unemployment, inflation, all the rest of it, are all based on money and the price system. And all of these unpaid, caring sectors, which actually, on a global basis, are much larger than the official money-denominated sectors. In many developing countries, over half of everything that goes on is unpaid, it's barter, it's trade in local marketplaces, and all of this kind of growing food for your own use and all of that kind of thing. And so we're so distorted now that basically, it's like we're trying to run our economies based on only the money and the price system. It's like trying to fly across a country at 60,000 feet, and you don't notice really what's going on the ground. And so this is why so many communities have been left behind, because they just don't come up in the statistics at all. And so one of the most important problems that I've focused on with GDP is not only that it doesn't consider these contributions from social society, but and the contributions of natural systems, whether it's bees pollinating our food or biodiversity or whatever, is also the fact that the GDP, unlike all other accounting, double entry accounting, does not have an asset side to the budget. It only records government investments in schools and roads and R&D and whatever as debt. And it doesn't put on the other side of the balance sheet all of the valuable investments that have been made with that government money. And so one of the things that needs to be done, and I'm always writing about this, is that every country is sort of governed by this idea that they have a debt to GDP ratio. Right now, we're all being terrorized by the economists telling us, oh my God, you know, the US debt to GDP ratio is going up and this is terrible. But if we had an asset side, it would immediately cut the debt to GDP ratio by up to 50%, just with a few keystrokes. And so the article I've just written comparing the issue that's going on about the US versus China is that we overestimate, we expect there's a Chinese bubble which is about to burst, but it's not at all, because they don't calculate their debt to GDP ratio without including the assets that have been created. You see, and so they have a completely different metric. And the economist profession has become over dominant in all government discussions. And I have often been called an anti-economist because I keep critiquing them and tell them, look, to step back and fix your own metrics first, and then we'll have a better discussion in the public sector.
Yeah, and this piece on China just was published a couple of days ago. You talk about China is already the largest economy in the world, measured in something called purchasing power parity, PPP,
yes,
which corrects for over and undervalued currencies.
Exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. Talk about currencies, because you also suggest in another piece that perhaps state and local entities could have their own currencies. We don't have to all just rely on the currency of the federal government. You mentioned a thing in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts called Berkshares that people trade and use for goods and services, and even banks accept. We had one for a time here in Baltimore. They were called Baltimore Bucks, and it was a currency that wasn't dollars and cents, but it was a usable currency in various retail establishments. Why would it be a good idea for the city of Baltimore or the state of Maryland to have its own currency?
Well, you know, these local currencies pop up all over the world, and I have used them for 20 years as a measure of how good and well-managed the national economy is. And, you know, there's no reason at all if a local town or city says, look, we can clear our own markets and we can match our own unemployed people with all kinds of domestic jobs and things that need to be done around our city, why shouldn't we just have a local currency? And for example, in Brazil now, for decades, many cities said, okay, you know, we have have a local currency. We're clearing our own markets. And the national government said, well, look, fine, go ahead, you know, because it makes a lot more sense than trying to run it all through the central bank. It's like, you know, the central bank is kind of a croupier that creates the chips that everybody can use to trade with each other. And if for some reason or other, the central bank's croupier is not distributing the chips very well, then okay, a local area should be able to create their own chips, just as they did with the Berkshires. And that's one of the most famous local currencies in the world. And it's accepted by all local banks. And it means that everybody who lives there in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, has a local currency in one pocket for all the local transactions, and US dollars in the other pocket for stuff that they have to go out into the national economy for. And so it creates a much more stable local situation and has fostered lots of local businesses and contract agriculture, community housing. And as I say, it's famous all over the world.
And back to this notion of the asset part of the ledger when we think about debt to GDP ratio. Republicans here in this country have somewhat recently rediscovered their concern with the national debt, and they are opposing Mr. Biden's proposal, for example, for the infrastructure bill. They're concerned that Mr. Biden's definition of infrastructure is too expansive, and they're concerned about spending another couple trillion dollars, having spent several trillion dollars on coronavirus-related things, you know, in very recent memory. So how would you frame that argument to them? What do you think they're missing when it comes to these expenditures? And if, in fact, there is on the asset side of the ledger, you know, a bunch of new bridges and airports and highways and hospitals, et cetera, you know, do we really go ahead and build it thinking that there is a much less acute effect on the deficit and the debt?
Well, yes, you see, absolutely. You see, what President Biden is doing really is bringing forward new investments we must make in our infrastructure, which is actually embarrassing on the world level. You know, it's crumbling, and the engineers have been saying for decades, you know, that we're about $3 trillion behind with maintenance and new investments. We haven't made any real new investments since Eisenhower's, you know, in road building, the interstate highway system, and of course, the moonshot from NASA. So we're way, way behind, and it's absolutely essential to make these new investments, whether it's a broadband for everybody or all of the things that are really in this infrastructure bill, particularly to create the new infrastructure for electric vehicles and all of the new urban, more efficient kind of energy systems, solar, wind, energy efficiency, and retrofitting buildings and all of that kind of thing. We must make these investments for future jobs and future economic growth.
And just so, very quickly, because we're almost out of time, and of course the argument is if we spend so much that we don't have, if we keep printing this money, we're going to have a terrible inflationary effect. We've only got 30 seconds left, but are you concerned about inflation?
No, not at all. And the problem is, you see, that they think that we have to borrow from bond dealers or from taxpayers, where actually the way it happens is that the Congress has the power of the purse. It lets contracts and it creates government bonds and lets them to the private sector. And that's how the Hoover Dam got built. I mean, otherwise Los Angeles would still be a village. You know, so they have it completely, I have to say, ass backwards.
Hazel Henderson is an economist and author and the founder of Ethical Markets. This has really been a fun conversation. Thank you so much. I hope we can have you back sometime.
Love it. Thank you so much, Tom.
Hazel Henderson will join several other speakers Sunday afternoon at the annual Logan Visionary Conference, sponsored by the American Visionary Art Museum. The theme of the event is Bigger Love. A bunch of other speakers in addition to Ms. Henderson. And we have got a link to that event on our website, wypr.org/midday. So that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Howard County Executive Calvin Ball and the acclaimed singer Navasha Dia join me. I hope you can join us too. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, coming up next after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.